This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern.
So we're going to do a few of our great listeners' questions today,
yes,
aren't we?
Yes, we are. Thank you for everyone who sent them in. We've got loads on all kinds of different topics. But one that's particularly caught our eye, because it's very much in the news at the moment, is to do with what's happening in the world of vets. And we've had this question in who says, I'm a veterinary professional and the CMA is currently reviewing the profession. I currently work at a corporate practice owned by one of the larger corporations, which are particularly being scrutinised. In the immediate aftermath of the announcement, I had a lot of blowback from clients assuming vets were practising unethically. God, I'm sorry to hear that. I want to know, who are the CMA and what is the significance of the industry being under review? Do you want to tell us just who the CMA are, first of all, Robert, and then we'll go into the specifics of this story?
So the Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA, is the body which has a statutory duty to investigate whether there is, you know, proper competition benefiting consumers throughout the economy. And they have been looking, they've been doing a scoping exercise when it comes to veterinary services. And we should be clear about this. I know, you know, there's a sort of thought, oh, vets, it's, you know, it's some sort of smallish, you know, industry. Why does it matter to anybody? Well, this is huge.
Yeah.
So 16 million people have pets. I mean, look, I know about this in my own case. You know, many people spend more money on the health of their pets than they do on themselves. You know, there is no National Health Service for pets. And the amount that you can be charged, I mean, years ago, we've got a dog, a Bedlington Whippet Cross called Merlin. He ran into a bush. He got spiked, the blood spewing everywhere. Because he was very, very young at the time, and I, for whatever reason, I think something had gone wrong with the renewal of our insurance. It cost thousands of pounds to save his life. You know, we had to take him to some special hospital. I mean, the amounts of money, you know, if you love your pet, yeah, that you have to spend is huge.
Yes.
Okay. And what the CMA also very interesting, and you know, shows you how important this market is to people. They had, I think, more than 50,000 replies to their scoping exercise, which is a huge number.
Yeah, they said, right? It's an unprecedented response, didn't they?
So, you know, this market matters to people. And talk me through, because I was really shocked. I mean, it didn't surprise me, but talk me through some of the things,
yeah,
that the CMA said about what was going wrong.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the big issues for customers are the lack of transparency. So most vet practices, they found, do not display their prices on their website, even for the most basic services. So like, they found that 80% of them had no pricing information online. Also, people were saying they're not always told about how much something's going to cost before they agree to it. And there's a whole big issue of there not being enough competition in the market. So a company can own multiple vet practices in the same area without making it clear to people, which means that you might, as a customer, be thinking, oh, I'll compare prices between different vet practices. But because you don't know they're all part of the same vet group, you have no idea you're comparing like for like. So that's a big issue.
And just on that, one of the things I was really struck by is the way that really recently there's been this massive increase in concentration in the market.
Yes.
I think they said that, you know, it was a few years ago, the big chains controlled, I think it was 10%. And now it's 50% or, yeah, even 60% of the market is controlled by the big international chains.
Yes, yeah. And that is the big problem. There's not enough competition. I was talking to my friend who works as a vet in one of these big corporates, and he was saying, you know, he's been a vet now for 10 years, and he said it's been incredible how much it's changed in that time in terms of vet practices, these independent ones being snapped up by these big groups. And there are, you know, the big groups, in case you're interested, CVS, IVC, Linus, Medivet, Pets at Home and Vet Partners. And they're the ones that have been snapping up all these companies. And he was
saying, I think, have got thousands of practices across the world, haven't they?
Yeah, they have, yeah. And he was saying to me, like, you know, they were told things won't change when we, you know, take you over. But he said in the time he's been working there, they've had years where prices have gone up two or three times in that year. And when he's questioned it as vets, because obviously they're the ones who are on the front line, the you know, the veterinary nurses and veterinary doctors, they're the ones who are having to say to someone, you know, I'm really sorry, it's going to cost you $2,500 to fix your dog. And fix is probably the wrong word. Can you tell I don't have a pet? But, you know, so they're the ones facing that. And then whenever they've questioned it, they keep being told, well, we're just bringing it in line with other companies. But the problem is there are now so few companies. It is becoming like a bit of a monopoly. It's a bit like the energy sector when we talk about the big six and, you know, them all being snapped up.
And there's another aspect of, well, two other aspects, which I think are really important about the lack of transparency about, you know, frankly, how they do their business. One of the things that I did not know, and I've only discovered by reading the CMA report, is that you can insist when you go to the vet that they write you a prescription for the medicines that your pet needs, and then you'll be able to buy that stuff, those medicines online or somewhere, or just wherever it's cheapest. You know, normally you just go to the vet and you assume that you have to buy the medicine from the vet you go to. But that's not true. Nobody in a vet ever tells you, you know, you can buy it cheaper elsewhere. And the CMA says there's a real risk that we're all being ripped off. And I think the other thing, which
just to add to that, though, these firms, some of them are making a quarter of their money from those medicines. So this is big, you know, it's a lot of revenue is coming from this. So it's understandable why they're not going to tell you.
I mean, we actually had this just the other day. The other thing that you can see is a lot of pets in my life at the moment. But one of our daughters has bought a puppy and he ate some poison. But the thing is, right, when there's a risk, you think you're going to lose, you know, the pet's going to die, you will, because you're panicking, you'll pay almost anything to save their lives. And again, you know, particularly if you go out of hours, right, they don't tell you in advance how much, well, you know, the prices are really steep and they don't always tell you in advance how much you're going to have to pay to save your pet's life. But at that point, they've got you over a barrel.
Yes, of course, because it's emotion.
And no, I mean, this stuff is, it's really difficult.
Of course it is. You know, as you say, people will pay whatever to save their pets. But my vet friend was also telling me that there is a huge misconception, though, about where the money goes. And he thinks it is because we don't have, you know, a private health service in this country. Said the way that they, you could look at it for veterinary practices by looking at how the US, how in the US they pay for private healthcare. Because he was saying, actually, the service you get for pets is incredible. You can get same day blood results. You can get X-rays same day. You can get things that you wouldn't as a human necessarily get on the NHS. And so he was saying people don't have anything to compare it to when they're paying these prices, so that they think they're paying a lot of money, but they're actually getting a really good service for it. And then he was saying there's also a huge discrepancy between some of the veterinary practices. So, and because people don't understand or necessarily see the pricing, they might think, oh, well, hang on, that person up the road is doing it for a lot cheaper, but they might be getting someone really junior and not getting the aftercare or whatever. So it actually is a really hard for consumers to compare between it all.
Sure. And I have to say, so two other things about this. I did, when I took, you know, Merlin to have his life saved after he'd had this terrible, you know, hemorrhage, the hospital we went to, which is on the edge of London, it was the most extraordinary state of the art hospital. I did think myself, I'd quite like to, you know, if I've got a problem, I'd quite like them to take me in here. It was certainly, it felt as modern and as swish as any NHS hospital I've ever been into. It was amazing. And then the one final thing is just, this is more about the emotion one feels about one's pets. So a whole variety of reasons. We had this big debate in our family about whether or not Merlin should be neutered, should be castrated. And, you know, we sort of came to the view that he should be. And then when I got him to the vet and he gave me that look, I thought, no, You can keep your balls. So he's never been done.
Oh, I love that. Just a couple of other things I wanted to mention on it. One of my friends as well is a pet expert called Chloe Fuller. She did the show with me, amazing girl who's, you know, just been doing Crufts and things like that. Anyway, she was saying to me that she knows quite a lot of people who are taking their pets to France to get treatment now because it's a lot cheaper there.
Is that right?
But you would think that the bureaucracy of taking your pet to France would make it more complicated. But she was saying that's a big thing. And the other point that I think quite a few of the people I know who work in this industry are saying to me is already it is tough being a vet. It's, you know, it is a bit like in the NHS frontline. It's very stressful. You know, you can be working long hours. And there is an issue of people taking their own lives in the veterinary sector. There's a charity called Not One More Vet, which is a campaign to stop this, because they say 70% of vets have lost a colleague to suicide.
Yeah.
I know, it's awful, isn't it? And what they're saying about this is they're worried, and this is what the person who sent in this question to us referred to as well, about the backlash they're going to get from people coming in now going, you're overcharging us, and those on the front line, you know, the people who are at the actual vets, you know, it's not their fault, all of this, but they're going to be getting
the... Many
of
their employees, these are not their businesses, yeah, is what you're saying.
And also the other thing about this is the regulation is out of date, isn't it? So the regulation for veterinary practices was set up in the 60s, the main regulation, and that was before non-vets were able to own vet practices. But obviously now lots of practices are now owned by these companies, but the regulation is for individual practitioners rather than practice owners, which, and they try to set up this voluntary code of conduct about things like pricing and transparency, because they couldn't make these companies do it because it didn't fit with the regulation. So they set up a voluntary code, but not everyone signed up to it. So only like 69% of the eligible practices signed up to it. So there was a big problem with regulation being out of date, which is hopefully what the Competition and Markets Authority will be able to fix in all of this.
Now, just very briefly before we move on, I mean, it does seem to me, and I think we should talk about this at some length on another occasion, that I'm not sure, actually, our regulators in general are necessarily serving our interests as well as they might. You only have to look at the sort of calamity in the water industry and sewage going to our streams and all the rest of it to realise quite how often regulators get things wrong. I do think you and I agree, however, that it's long overdue that the veterinary market was looked at properly.
Yes, definitely. And I think most people in it would say that, but it just needs to be done with care so that the vets themselves are not going to, you know, suffer because of this. Right, let's have a quick break then, and then we'll answer some more questions.
Great.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston. Now, we've got a really interesting question from Jonathan Haps about the black or dark economy. He says, can you imagine any government legalising and therefore taxing marijuana and or prostitution as they've done in Amsterdam? The dark economy is worth billions. Is it time to look at all... Well, he's basically saying, should we decriminalise or legalise some of these industries?
Yeah, so funny, because when I was growing up in Middlesbrough, the drugs sector was pretty booming, and so was the prostitution. And you know, one of my dance classes was in a hall which was in the middle of the red light district, which was a bit awkward whenever my dad came and picked me up, but there we are. And I've seen the dark side of it, and so I kind of am of the view that something like prostitution, drugs I have, I think, a bit of a different view on, but prostitution, sex is like the oldest business in the world, isn't it? So people are always going to pay for sex, aren't they? People who can't get it are always going to pay for it. So therefore, I just think that we should have it as a legitimate industry. I totally appreciate that there is the argument of exploitation, and there's the argument of, you know, do women, because obviously it's majority women, do they really want to do this? Would this, you know, aren't they being abused in this situation? But I think it's always going to happen. Therefore, we should try and make it safer and get revenue from it.
I mean, there's this very similar sort of argument when it comes to particularly cannabis. So, you know, you can't spend any time in London and not smell people smoking it. Literally, one of the problems is, of course, that the weed that is sold and is, you know, produced illegally is often the absolutely worst quality, that is more addictive, leads to worse mental health issues. And so there is quite apart from whether or not there's a very useful source of, you know, revenue for government, the equivalent of, you know, the duty on alcohol or on tobacco, there is also the quality control aspect, which is if you had decriminalisation and indeed licensed producers of various sorts, would the stuff that was then sold be less damaging to people? And I think that is an issue that we need to debate. There's too much hysteria around this. On the other hand, I have to say, I've been, you know, was in New York recently where they have decriminalized and there are lots of, you know, cannabis shops everywhere. And there's an interesting period, certainly during that initial period of novelty when you set up these shops, that as far as I can see, almost everybody in New York was stoned when I was there, which I'm not 100% certain is great for New York. But, you know, if I'm honest with you, I am broadly one of those who thinks that we should move towards decriminalisation, just because I have seen so much damage done to young people by this really awful stuff that is sold. And I think we've just got to do, education gets you so far. Certainly, you know, it's far too big a job for the police to basically get this stuff off the streets. And therefore, if you can't get it off the streets, you've just got to make sure that the quality of it is better. And at the same time, you know, if this stuff is being sold, why shouldn't there be a benefit to the exchequer?
Yeah. I don't know if I agree on the drugs point, though, because I've never, ever, ever tried drugs in my life. And you would think, given where I grew up, that I would have. But the thing that has put me off is seeing the dark side of it in terms of, you know, my friends' parents who are addicts, or seeing the kind of the poverty and desperation and all of that side of it. And that totally put me off as a kid. I thought, I don't want to end up like that. And I think now it's been glamorized. Drugs have been glamorized. And my worry is, if they were legalized, then I would have thought as a kid, if they were legalized, I would have been like, oh, I'll try it. It's all right, because the government says it's safe.
I would agree with you if I thought that, you know, you made a choice. Loads of young people, particularly because of social media, the enormous pressures on young, you know, young people have always thought, I know best about substances. And, you know, that is now true in spades, particularly because of social media. So I think the notion that you can simply, criminalise and protect people, you need more than that.
Yeah, but it's the longer term mental health impacts from even like low level cannabis smoking. I've seen that in friends, and I think that's the thing that it feels like you might be condoning. I totally get your point. Do you know what? I tell you what's brilliant on all of this is that series Top Boy, which is obviously about a kind of a drugs gang or various drug gangs.
Yeah, it's not weed. It's much harder drugs. Anyway, there's a big debate here, and we should come back to it in more detail at some point.
Yes. So I'm all for the prostitutes and you're all for the drugs.
No, I'm not all for the drugs. I'm just saying I don't think we have a particularly rational debate in this country about it, and I'd like to see a more rational debate about it.
Right, let's have another question, shall we? I mean, I get asked this a lot. I'm sure you do too. How does the ONS work out inflation? And this is all about the shopping basket of goods, which they use to compare prices. And they change it every year, don't they, in terms of they look at what we're all buying, what kind of things have come in and out of fashion. And then from that, they build up this shopping basket, they call it. It's got about over 700 items in it. And normally they take out between 10 and 20 every year and put 10 or 20 in. And it's been quite interesting what actually has come out and what's gone in, because an old relic of the past has gone in, hasn't it? Tell us about that.
Well, the additions that caught, you know, my eye, and I imagine yours too, were air fryers. I've never used an air fryer. Do you use an air fryer?
Do I use an air fryer? Do you know what? Whenever I see the ONS, what's gone in, I always think I am the absolute consumer that inflation is based on, because I am air fryer, edible seeds. I'm all about the edible seeds this year. That's one of the other things that have gone in. But vinyl's gone in, hasn't it? And that's you, isn't it?
Yeah, so I love a bit of vinyl. I mean, before we get on to vinyl, it's also interesting to me that gluten-free bread is in there. It is interesting how our diets are changing. And, you know, I mean, there are lots of people actually who I have to say with long COVID have cut gluten out of their diet. And so I think this, some of this is actually related to really quite big societal changes. Some of it still related to that awful epidemic we're living through. Anyway, interesting that gluten-free bread is in there. But yeah, the vinyl thing is fascinating because, you know, it's amazing how it's gone from being an obsolete technology through to something that was regarded as a bit eccentric to be interested in. And now pretty much every big artist wants to put their music out on vinyl along with digital. Yeah. I mean, I love vinyl. Yeah, I do think the sound is just richer. It's different. I love the scratches even, you know. But actually, I'll tell you what, I bought something fantastic the other day. I was in East Anglia and there was a junk shop and I bought for 20 quid something which I think is worth rather more than that, which is a 1964 French Les Beatles album, which is a real thing, right? It was a sort of Beatles compilation from 1964, produced only for the French market, and it's the most beautiful object apart from anything else because the cover is so amazing. Yeah, so, you know, if you're like me, you take the view that vinyl should never have dropped out of...
Well, it was 30 years ago it was last included in the shopping basket on the ONS.
Is that really true?
Yeah, 30 years ago, they say.
Wow.
I know. So it just shows you what else might come back.
Anyway, but the interesting thing about inflation always is the question of whether what the inflation figure shows really reflects people's experience of the cost of living. And I think we should just point out very briefly here that it's an average, right? They tried to put in their goods and services that reflect, you know, a typical person's experience. And, you know, there'll be people listening to this saying, I never eat gluten-free bread. And so why on earth is that being included? Well, it's about, as I say, trying to come up with a basket that, you know, covers enough of our experience to represent something important. But as we all have been talking about, and you and I have talked about during the cost of living crisis, depending how much money you've got, it either looks like an understatement or an overstatement. And one of the things that was really important as we talked about cost of living during the worst of that crisis is if you're on a low income, okay, the bit of the inflation index that is way more important to you is food, because it takes up a way bigger proportion of your basket of shopping. And, you know, the problem with having a whole range of goods in the inflation basket is, you know, it will understate if food is going up as it was for a period at 25% on an annualized basis and inflation is only going up at 10%, that inflation number understates what's really happening to you in terms of the squeeze on your cost of living. So none of us should take the view that the inflation measure is perfect, but it's sort of the best we've got.
Yes. And there's a lot of research that goes into why they pick each product. Because, for example, like on the gluten-free bread thing, the reason they went for that is because they noticed that the shelf space now for gluten-free products is now a lot bigger. And they picked bread as the particular product because they said that gives the best coverage. It's the most representative item in terms of what people might buy. And that, so that gluten-free bread is to represent all gluten-free products, really. And then there's loads of other products they do that with as well to just try and represent it. But as you say, that can mean there's big price changes that'll be missed because it's not included in people's basket of goods.
And let's be clear, lots of people are still struggling, but, you know, statistically, and indeed, not just statistically, in terms of real lives, you know, real wages are now increasing. You know, inflation is below the increase in wages. We had that confirmed again just this week. And inflation, particularly food inflation, is, you know, it's falling very significantly.
Right, we've got time for one more. This one is from Andy Rimmer. Now, most of the post-COVID national debt is owed to the Bank of England. Who buys government bonds? Can you explain how this works and why the Bank of England can't just cancel this debt? Would this not be deflationary?
Okay, so let's not go into enormous detail about this because we're going to come back to this on another occasion. So just to remind people, the government borrows by selling gilts bonds to investors. And since the financial crisis of 2008, and this was very much an innovation then, the Bank of England started in a process known as quantitative easing to buy hundreds, actually, in total, of billions of these bonds, which is effectively the Bank of England buying the debt of the government. And the reason it did that was because when it was buying the debt, the price of that debt rose, which meant that the borrowing cost for the government fell. Now, actually, just to go back to Andy's question, that's now gone into reverse. Right. That was the original process of buying the debt was called quantitative easing. The Bank of England is now selling the debt. It's called quantitative tightening. And the reason it is selling the debt is because buying the debt is regarded as a way of stimulating the economy. And indeed, that would be regarded to an extent as inflationary. Selling the debt, quantitative tightening, makes interest rates higher. Right. And so it started selling the debt because it wanted to bear down on inflation. And to go to Andy's particular question, he says, wouldn't cancelling the debt be deflationary? No. In terms of most sort of classical economic views, and even Keynesians would agree with this, when you cancel debt, you are basically creating money. Right. Now, there is an argument that says that even when they buy the debt, they are creating money. But you are what you're doing is you are cancelling an obligation that the government has that is creating free money for the government. And that in itself would be regarded as very inflationary.
Sorry. I was just going to say, like, an example in personal finances would be if suddenly someone said to you, you don't need to pay back your mortgage, you would then have more money to spend on things, which would push up inflation.
That's a very good analogy. And that's probably a good point to leave this particular discussion. Now, there'll be some people listening who will be saying, what about modern monetary theory or MMT, which is this very fashionable view that actually, you know, the Bank of England should just be creating lots of free money. And we will come back to that at some point.
Yes, we've had questions in on that too. So that is a good one. But thank you very much for the questions. And just a reminder, you can email them into us, therestismoney@gmail.com. And also you can send them in on our social media pages. Just search for The Rest Is Money. But that's it from us. Goodbye.
All the best. Bye-bye.